as I've mentioned, has the fundamental limitation that it deals not at all with political authorities and with governmental responsibilities. But at the same time that this movement towards legislating land rights and confirming them through land courts has been going on, there have been a couple of other things going on which deal more directly with the issues of governmental authority. And one is the development of a powerful rhetoric asserting Aboriginal sovereignty over Australia, period. And the language of that assertion is simple, it's pay the rent. And it's directed to the white tenants, to the settlers who came after 1788 and who took over land, who dispossessed the Aborigines, who aren't about to admit that the possession is no longer theirs, and are saying that they're quite happy to sit down and negotiate an appropriate rental. It's a notion which is not welcome to the Commonwealth government and to the tenants, but it's one that isn't about to go away, and it's one that is providing energy for the move to broaden the notion of Aboriginal rights through that legislation. It's also providing the Aborigines with some sense of what they're doing when they make certain kinds of accommodations, that they're securing some land and that the deals that they're entering into are land deals, but they're maintaining their prerogative to talk about the questions of sovereignty at a more auspicious time. So they've tried carefully to enter into the discussions about land rights as portrayed within the legislation in a way that will keep intact the notion of sovereignty. They're also moving in a different way, in a way similar to the kind of move that was described yesterday, acting as though they had sovereign rights, acting as governments. What they're doing is, all over Australia, moving back from the settlements out to the country. The movement is called various things, the outstation movement or the move to settle down country, but it's happening from the central deserts up to North Queensland, the tropical area, down to the south, and Aboriginal groups who over the years have been moved in or have moved themselves in to settlements close to town or to settlements where several tribes have been brought together for administrative purposes are going back to land and acting in every way as as though it were their land, as indeed it is. They're refusing to accept that land as anything other than theirs, and they're defying the anxiety and the opposition of many of the state and Commonwealth authorities that are saying you can't do that, folks, and it won't work, and that's not on, and so forth. They're just moving back, and that's having a powerful effect on people's thinking about the notion of Aboriginal sovereignty. The other thing that's happening, and it's part of this, is that out of the communities there are coming some very powerful local organizations. The most interesting and the most striking of which in many ways is the Aboriginal Medical Service, the Aboriginal Health Services, which are community-based, community-run, which are the product initially of urban Aborigines in Redfern, a suburb of Sydney, and in Fitzroy, a suburb of Melbourne, and which have federated together in a group called the National Aboriginal and Islander Health Organization. The communities themselves, the local Aboriginal medical services are service organizations. They provide a range of medical services from the technical to the more holistic. They rely on Aboriginal people as much as possible and hire others, doctors, technicians, and so forth, where necessary. They provide a broad range of social services within those communities. They act as a focus for what are essentially assertions of Aboriginal sovereignty. And drawing from that local energy, the National Aboriginal and Islander Health Organization has been one of the key proponents of land rights, using the powerful argument that ill health, and that the ill health that's epidemic among Aboriginal people, is a product of dispossession and dislocation. And the only way to good health is to provide the stability and security that broadly based land rights will provide. And that it would include in due course, as part of the notion, the power to govern the land and to control those communities. As an indication of the interconnectedness, that outstation movement, that movement that I described a minute ago, is not only strongly supported by the National Aboriginal and Islander Health Organization, but most of the material relating to it has come through that organization. There's a book out called Settle Down Country, which came out last year, which provides an account of what's going on, and that's published by the health organization. So there aren't the tidy divisions that have often been the bane of Aboriginal communities trying to bring things together. One of the difficulties, and this may be of some interest, and it's certainly related to the conversation yesterday, there are other local Aboriginal organizations, one of the earliest of which were the Aboriginal Legal Services, which came out of the local communities and which again are federated into a National Aboriginal and Islander Legal Service. The difficulty with those is that they've been bound into a legal system which is fundamentally alien in many respects to Aboriginal life, and yet their defense of their clients or claims against other parties within that system reinforces the system itself. So they've not been as effective as the Aboriginal Medical Service has been putting forward an argument that it's all part of a seamless web. That said, the Aboriginal Legal Service has been a crucial part of the development of Aboriginal rights in Australia, providing, as it were, survival rations to the communities, keeping them, holding them together until such time as they can work out a more comprehensive and coherent framework. There are some other things which fall into the same pattern and may be of some interest. And it's a simple thing in many ways, but it's a powerful expression of Aboriginal rights in Australia, is the Aboriginal flag. The circle in the center, red, black, and yellow. It's everywhere in Australia. No one in Australia can avoid the expression of Aboriginal rights as embodied in that flag. It appears all over the place. It appears on it's the color coding of all of the Aboriginal medical centers in the cities. It's a part of many of the buildings. It flies over the buildings. It's a part of all their publications. It's on bumper stickers. It may not at all be an appropriate thing for other Indigenous people. As Browning Pipestem was saying yesterday, these things have to take on the image of the people they represent. And I'm not suggesting that everyone should have a flag. I'm just saying that it is a powerful expression of Aboriginal identity. Along with it goes the expressions such as the pay the rent concept, as it's called, and not least the enormously articulate energy of the Aboriginal arts, the painting and the sand, the bark painting and the sand painting, but even more important, the writing and the theater and the filmmaking that have been part of the assertion of Aboriginal land rights in the last 10 years. And they've been important in ways that sort of go beyond any narrow sense of what the arts are all about. They have been the vehicle for the expression of Aboriginal rights. They've also been a way for the Aborigines to find a language that catches their own particular predicament. It's a language of ideals and aspirations. It's a language that can be taken seriously. It's a language that comes to life, into which they can breathe life in the way that was mentioned yesterday. It's a language that it becomes part of their charters, becomes part of the constitutions of organizations like the National Aboriginal and Islander Health Organization, and it's a language that in due course will undoubtedly become part of whatever constitution enshrines notions of Aboriginal autonomy and Aboriginal, broadly based Aboriginal rights. That notion of language is crucial, I think. And I'm not only talking about whether the language is Athabaskan or Inuktitut or whatever. It's a sense of a shaping of the predicament, the aspirations and the anxieties in a particular kind of way. And no American could be ignorant of the importance of language. The American Constitution is a marvelous document because of its language and the expression of certain ideals. Ideals which have their own kind of impracticality, ideals of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and so forth. The possibilities within Aboriginal society for finding their own language are no less crucial. And that language may take the form of laws. Laws are nothing but language. Or it may take the form of bringing back traditions in a certain kind of way. One of the ironies in early on in my time in Australia, and again this picks up something that was raised yesterday, was that I kept hearing as I was out in the communities references to tribal law, and I realized eventually that I was hearing references to two things in an Australian accent. One was tribal law, L-A-W, the other was tribal lore, L-O-R-E. They both sounded the same, and indeed, in many ways, they both were the same. They were inseparable. They were part of the same thing. They weren't tidally divided up. And the similarity in sound matched a similarity in what the people were talking about. I'll just finish up by coming back to a point I raised a minute ago, the importance of the Aboriginal arts, because I want to quote a passage from a play that has been very important in Australian Aboriginal affairs in the last few years, very important in the move towards a broader notion of Aboriginal land rights. A play called The Cake Man by the black writer Robert Merritt. And there's a character, the main character is a man called Sweet William. At a certain point early in the play, he comes in and he says, looks at the audience and he says, who you? And then he looks around and he says, you want to buy a boomerang? And the boomerang, it turns out, is made in Japan. And the Australian champion boomerang thrower, it turns out, is a white fellow. But Sweet William, on the other hand, as he says, is a Koori. I'm a Koori, the Australian Aborigine. That's who I am and what I am, made in England. And then he moves on in his sort of monologue, and he says, "You still there? I still got something that you want. What do you want from me that I got? Don't be scared. Just say it. That's what I want to know too." And that question haunts the play, and it haunts Australia in many ways. And towards the end of the play, the question is turned around, but the riddle sort of persists. So William comes out right in the last scene of the play and comes out and speaks again to the audience. And he says, well, don't matter. Please don't give it another thought. Forget all that shit they say about giving me back my culture. That shit. It isn't what I'm really after. Not really. What I want, what I'm here for is something else again. If I could only get across what I mean. Look, I'll tell you something. No laughing. You're not allowed to laugh. But you got to try to listen and not call me a liar or laugh. I'm not no liar. Ask Rube, my missus. She'll tell you that's one thing about me, that I ain't a liar. You ever heard of a Yuri woman? You say it like that, Yuri woman. No? Never heard of them? Well, listen then, I'll tell you what's a Yuri woman and what it is I want here. I was working at Killara Station. After it had me feed, I went and laid down on the bed and started reading this Gubba book I got. The Gubba is white man. And all of a sudden, I heard this emu drumming somewhere close. I got up and went outside and stroked up the fire. And all the time, this emu was still drumming. I was trying to hear exactly where it was so I could find that nest. Then the drumming started closer to the tent. I was sort of curious, like, you know. I thought I won't have no trouble finding that nest in the morning. But this time it was right behind the tent. So, while I was turning around, I got the biggest fright of my whole life. It weren't no emu, it was a woman. And she had hair that was shining black, and it hung right down over her backside. She was the prettiest woman I ever saw. Yeah, she was a Yuri woman. I fair bolted out of there. You'd have thought I had wings the way I flew out of there. It didn't do me no good, though. Must have run easy a mile. But just as I ducked through the fence wires, there she was again, right in front of a man, between me and the road. And it was summer, hot as fucking hell, but I had this freeze-cold sweat all over me. And then I took off again, running for me life, scarier than I ever was before, running fast. But didn't matter how or where, she was always there in front of me, and at the same distance away from me, her hair shining and swirling like it was made out of water, and her skin like black lightning, if you can imagine that. So beautiful, she couldn't ever be bad. But she was scary anyway, and always there in front of me, but somewhere else. Well, all I remember then is a Gubba I was working for was saying to me, "What was wrong? What happened?" And I said, "Didn't he see that Yuri woman?" And just the way he looked at me, I knew he never had, and that he never would, and never could see that Yuri woman. A Gubba. Ain't no Yuri womans for Gubbas. She came to tell me so I'd know. "You know what?" The Gubba said, "Come on, William, ain't no Yuri woman. Come back to reality." Exactly what the Yuri woman was saying, too. Two realities. And I've lost one. But I want it back. I need it back. It's not yours, it's mine. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Ted. Well, I think this is a good time to adjourn for lunch and come back at 1:45, and we'll carry on. Yeah, so I'd like to get to that, yeah. There you I think we might as well start. We've had one whole side of the table here fall by the wayside, but what can you do? to start with, I should say that at 5 o'clock this evening, there's a reception at David Case's office, and you're all invited, including the folks in the gallery. And what's the address there, David?
It's the Hunt Building, 550 West 7th, in room 1380. And I think that Joyce is printing up some, the commission secretary is printing up some tags and to tell you where it is and all. But it'll be at from 5 to 7 at the Hunt Building, room 1380.
And those of you who've been to the commission offices after the round tables in the past for our little receptions know how grungy our offices are. Well, this is, today it's the Hunt Building. I mean, this is real. Anyway, what I thought we would do this afternoon is just look at the uses of municipal government and their counterparts. We've already looked at Greenland, and there's been some discussion about the Kativik regional government in northern Quebec, but I thought that this afternoon we would ask Bill Dubé to speak, and then Senator Vic Fisher, and then Bob Blodgett would like to say a few words as well. And after that, perhaps we could move on to the question of the relationship between native governments and ANCSA corporations and some of the issues that we're still wrestling with there. So, Bill Dubé, why don't you start off and...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the opportunity to address you again. I'd like to announce that the mayor's assistant, Rex Okakak, was not able to attend, and he sends his regrets. There was a death in his family up in the North Slope, and he flew back to Barrow this morning. And in his absence, I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have about the borough. I'd like to address just some comments regarding municipal government. Oftentimes, there's given the impression that because ANCSA did not address the question of government for Alaskan Natives, that the Natives were left out on a limb and that they have been operating without governmental procedures or planning or anything like that since that time. And I'd like to present a little different perspective. I think one way of looking at ANCSA is seeing it as an adjunct of the Statehood Act. The Land Claims Act, it can be looked upon as a way of getting through to statehood and to proceeding with the promise of statehood. And there was a lot of Native support for statehood, but because of the failure of the federal government to settle land claims, the state could not be developed, nor could the promise of statehood be fulfilled. And so there's that problem that had to be gotten out of the way. Of course, you get the suits that stopped the development of the North Slope and the freeze put on the entitlements going on in Alaska. And this led, of course, to the Settlement Act. Native governance was addressed in statehood. which received a lot of support from Native leaderships and groups throughout the state. And I think the attitude at the time was a lot of the Native leaders were ready to opt out of the tribal system, wanted to throw in their lot with other Alaskans, and saw statehood as a way out from underneath the often bureaucratic and unresponsive system that was run by the Department of Interior. And Bob Arnold talks about this in his book. He calls it an implied state-native relationship. And John Havelock mentions this in his testimony here at the first overview hearings. He says it's a mistake to think that a lot of federal governance responsibilities are passed from the federal government to the regional corporations or the profit corporations in ANCSA. Those responsibilities really passed over at the time of statehood from the federal government to the state. And so you see a great deal of implementation and energy and involvement by the natives of the state with both the Constitution, the implementation of the Constitution, especially with the writing of the Municipal Code and the Borough Act in 1961. I think there was an amendment in 1963 setting up the state system of municipal government. And I think it's important to see these as native governments. And there's the implication a lot of times that IRA governments or other forms of government are more native than whatever else that the natives are using. And I think there's a real trap in that, because a lot of people can use that type of argument, saying that traditional governments or native governments have been disrupted. And just like the people who say that natives cannot be given subsistence rights because they're no longer using traditional implements, that they are also deprived of their Aboriginal governance rights because they're no longer using traditional government. And I think just as they are entitled to use whatever implements they choose, you know, to carry on their subsistence lifestyle, so they're also entitled to use whatever forms of government they choose in order to retain this very important political link with their past. And a lot of them have become very involved in implementing these various levels of municipal and state government at the local level. It was mentioned yesterday that the corporations are the most visible institutions in the villages. I really think the civic governments, the municipal governments, are the most visible. They certainly are the ones through which most of the funding and the capital improvements projects and important services are channeled, including education, medical care, and that type of thing. But there are also a tremendous amount of implementation of other programs, including planning programs and advisory actions on every level of government that are implemented, you know, by municipal governments at the local level. And I'd just like to issue a caution that the state has really involved itself much more in this whole issue of native governance for Alaska Natives than the federal government ever has. And this was one of the key issues of the framers of the Constitution. They were very concerned about giving rural people the highest powers of government because of the bad way in which the federal government treated all Alaskans for so long, over such a long period of time. They conceived of the borough as a way of giving the highest possible powers to rural people. They were in effect talking about creating mini states where these regional governments had full state powers. And they're talking about such things as even abolishing the city governments, because they saw the need for giving real full powers to these regional governments that were able to stand up to the multinational companies who they knew were coming to Alaska, had come to Alaska, and with whom they'd had very bad experiences in depleting natural resources during the 100-year history of American possession of Alaska. And I think it's really important for people at this stage of the game to understand the thinking that went behind the planning of the borough system. For one thing, they intended that the whole state be incorporated into different boroughs. And the original framers of the Constitution thought that this would take place very soon. Of course, they didn't really legislate very much about the boroughs, but that was their hope. And we've heard several comments from people here at this meeting about the importance of regional governments. David Case's paper talks about home rule villages. And that's a very good point, but his statement is weak when he's talking about monitoring the development of areas, contiguous to the villages and outside of the villages and outside tribal lands. Because, boy, when a multinational start marching up your road, you need to assemble a whole army in order to protect your interests in the lands. And your interests often go far beyond tribal lands or the Yangtze lands or village ownership lands, oftentimes subsistence use areas. What we are concerned about involved state lands, involved federal lands, involve private property. And it's important to retain or to establish jurisdiction and planning powers over those things. And certainly this might be possible in a federally located regime of some kind. And I would think of a regional native group like the Inupiat Corporation of the Arctic Slope or something like that might be able to develop enough planning and negotiating powers to do something like that. But what I'm saying is that the borough has already got those things set up. There's certainly strong traditions in federal native law and federal native tradition, for the control of resources. But when you start talking about control of resources that are beyond the jurisdiction of the tribe, municipalities have even more developed traditions and strengths. One of the problems, of course, dealing with the boroughs was that after the Constitution was passed, there was very little legislation about what the rights or the duties of the boroughs or how they're to be set up. And there was very little interest in the legislature to do that until 1961. They passed a bill, and then 1963 they passed a bill. And at that time we received, the state received, its structure of government. You had unincorporated villages, which we have about 100 of out there. And then you've got your second class villages and your first class villages, and then your home rule villages. And on the regional basis, you've got the unorganized boroughs, and everything in Alaska that's not in an organized borough is in unorganized boroughs, but also you can have second class boroughs, which can be unorganized too, and first class boroughs, which are able to exercise wide state-like authority over their whole jurisdiction. The difference between a first class borough and a second class borough has to do with the powers exercised out of the urban areas. In a second class borough, the borough has to confer with and get the approval of people in rural areas before they can engage in certain programs. And in the first class borough, all of the powers are exercised borough-wide. And then you have the home rule borough. The home rule boroughs and the home rule cities are exactly the same as the first-class boroughs and the first-class cities, except for the fact that they are not state chartered. They evolve their own charter, which they see as the source of their powers and not the state constitution or the state, or I should say the state municipal code. Now, one of the problems for rural areas is that the borough plan as envisioned by the framers of the Constitution was not implemented. And for obvious reasons, the state was very busy setting up its own structure, and the people were trying to get basic services out to the villages, and there was a lot of resistance that you are quite aware of the state unwilling to give up powers. And you see exactly the same thing going on in Cope today. Under the Cope Land Claim Settlement Act, there's provision for the Western Arctic Regional Municipality. Well, the government of Northwest Territories is very reticent to give up any powers to that and is campaigning actively, you know, to prevent the formation of that municipality. And you've got the situation with where Mr. Sebastian, who is in charge of regional local government for the government of Northwest Territories, he's touring the villages of Cope and trying to get them to go along with just an advisory regional council and not a regional government. Well, the plan was that Eben Hobson envisioned a whole chain of regional governments across the Arctic that could institute and implement wide-ranging planning powers, and he saw Arctic policy developing out of these strong regional governments that could actually legislate, set up a environmental regime that would regulate, that would have the capacity of regulating offshore development. The state was very remiss eventually in setting up regional governments, and I'm sure a lot of the problems that people find in rural areas comes from that fact. I think the very existence of the nonprofit corporations in Alaska is kind of an indictment against the state. And the nonprofit corporations kind of sprung up willy-nilly without any governmental authorization. And what they're coterminous with the profit corporation areas, and they act, I believe, in the absence of any borough government. You don't have a nonprofit in the North Slope borough because, you know, they've got the, well, they've got the North Slope borough that acts as the distributor of social services up there. In the other areas where you don't have organized boroughs, these nonprofits sprung up and they actually provide many of the social services that would otherwise be provided by a regional government. And this in itself indicates the need for regional government and the importance of it. That you have, you know, this kind of this spontaneous expression that you need some stronger regional power that can provide these services that the individual villages cannot provide for themselves. And the nonprofit corporations are incorporated, of course, and they're able to contract with the state and the federal government and also with other agencies, with the villages and other corporations in providing services. And they provide a wide range of services dealing with planning, subsistence provisions, wildlife management, and in some areas they provide medical services and even operate hospitals. And they're a very important part of the delivery of social services in Alaska. Now, the framers of the Constitution, you know, wanted to simplify this, wanted to prevent the multiplicity of governmental institutions in rural areas. You know, they envisioned the kind of bureaucratic system we have in rural areas now, and they They wanted to eliminate a lot of that, you know, with the borough system. This would allow the these rural areas to deliver services with the minimum of bureaucratic overlays, the minimum of governmental institutions, and it's certainly something to keep in mind. Other commentators have come along after the fact, like McBeath and Morehouse and Leask in their books, and say, well, maybe the system that exists in the rural areas might be the best thing going so far, because people living there certainly have other choices. They can upgrade their systems, they can organize boroughs. Well, we can say something about that. But perhaps this very diffuse system where people are kind of catching different services as they need them from different institutions as they need them, you know, is their choice, and maybe that has to be respected. If a city, for example, wants to remain at a second-class level or an unincorporated level, and it's getting its full range of federal services and federal money and state services, you know, maybe it wants to stay there. I think it's very important to provide that these options remain open to all of the villages, and to increase these options. And perhaps I think the commission could look into what John Havelock was talking about, namely the needs and the discontents and the complaints that we find in the villages today. Maybe they can be met on an individual level also, or they have to be met on an individual level, but usually it involves finding what particular services these people need. They want more control over their land. Well, how can we give them more control over the land without overlaying another form of government on them, or without overlaying them with another bureaucracy? I think a good medical approach is to go into each individual village and find out the problems that they face and their particular needs within their particular structures, and then apply the simplest possible remedies to start out with. And oftentimes, as John Havelock mentioned, maybe this just means an adjustment with the delivery of services from the state, an adjustment in the code itself, the municipal code itself. And perhaps these things can be worked out, you know, very easily. And I'm not just speaking from a standpoint of a bureaucrat that says, we don't want any radical changes, because that's not my purpose here. What I'm talking about is that we really have to respect the commitments of people to the structures that they already have, and they certainly are big commitments. People, it's not as if we were dealing with a blank tablet and we can restructure everything overnight here. People do have governments; they have big commitments to many different levels of governments, and they have certainly already worked out, in a quite admirable form, a number of their governmental problems. A lot of people are complaining about the overlay of governments and what I call the arrival of big government in the villages. And if you want to describe big government, it has to do with a variety and a multiplication of programs. And every time you have a program, you have a mobilization for that program of these resources, of law, of personnel, of organization, and of revenues in that area. And certainly they put a lot of demands on local people. For example, the state, with its oil money, can come up with a new program, let's say a sanitation program or a medical program, and go approach a village and say, do you want this new program? And they'll say, yeah, we need safe water, we need a new service of some kind. And in the setting up of that program, it has to make room and it's going to mobilize and exploit certain resources in that village. And you do this a number of times and things just blossom. And David mentioned this in his paper. It really is a big problem. In the city of Teller, they have 58 positions that have to be filled by local people to administer these programs. And all these positions are filled by just 10 people. Now the question is, we can't say that this is not what those people want in every case. You go out to the villages and you see that they are admirably taking care of a lot of these programs, and you see the city mayor and his staff and everybody else working so hard, and they're very proud of their work, and they're doing a fantastic job in interfacing with a very sophisticated number of state and federal programs. And and you have to see that with services come these obligations. And I hear a lot of people talking as if in a never-never land where they think they can get services or more control without more responsibility and more demands and more levels of bureaucracy and burdens on their own time. And there's hardly any way in which you can get that more control. And so the real issue, you know, whether you're going to go the state route and upgrade and refine your state systems, or whether you want to go the federal route or using native federal law, the whole issue is, do you need more government or do you need less government? If you see the multinationals coming up your road, you're probably going to need a lot more government right away. You're going to have to assemble a whole army of writers, technicians, attorneys, doctors, nurses, filmmakers, planners, engineers.